Thanks, Carl. So indeed, I have some remarks to make on decoherence and the universality thereof in the macro world. The project, I've been working on this project together with Daniel Braun and Walter Strunz. Walter is here, in back. Question is, of course, a very old one. The founding fathers have been quite aware of it. Einstein and Schrödinger asked and wondered why one can never see the superposition in the quantum sense of the dead state of a cat and the live state of a cat. Now, why so? Quantum mechanics would suggest the possibility of such a superposition. My favorite way of posing the paradox, if you so wish, is that of the skier's paradox. Why is it not possible to ski downhill full speed and head on towards a tree, surround it, but neither on the left nor on the right, but both ways, and then go on unharmed? Any photon can do that. Any electron can do it, and more massive particles have been shown to be able to do that as well. So why not skiers or other macroscopic bodies? The question is really the same as the one that arises in the context of measurement theory. A pointer in an apparatus can point any direction it is told to. Displacement phi 1 or phi 2, and these displacements certainly correspond to some quantum state each. And inasmuch as the pointer is a macroscopic object, one never sees any kind of interference effect coming from a superposition of these two states. So why that? The answer, or one part of the answer, is very old, and it comes in principle from Young's two-slit experiment. If you have a wave coming from behind that is cut into two partial waves, each from each of the two slits, interference thereafter. And as we learn in our elementary optics education, the angular aperture of the diffraction pattern is given by the ratio of the wavelength and the distance between the two slits. And when that ratio is of order unity, you have an easy time to resolve the interference pattern. But when the wavelength decreases relative to the split, to the slit separation, the angular aperture becomes smaller and the fringes become ever more difficult to see. Now, if you throw massive particles through a double slit, the role of lambda is taken over by the de Broglie wavelength, and that is a small quantity for very lightweight particles like electrons and neutrons, but it is an it is already small for such lightweight particles, but it is exceedingly small for macroscopic massive bodies like tennis balls or skiers. So the diffraction pattern for skiers thrown around trees or through double slits is too narrow to resolve. So that's one elementary explanation of why there is no interference of superpositions in the quantum sense in the macroscopic world. I have nothing to add to that. I will want to comment on another reason for the impossibility of seeing such interferences, and that is the coherence. Macroscopic bodies, when they move, also smaller bodies, mesoscopic bodies, when they move through space, are always coupled to some kind of environment, however weak that environment may, that coupling may be. And it turns out that the damping influence of such an environment in the quantum context comes with two different timescales. One is the timescale which I will call tau dissipation here, and that's characteristic of the damping visible in properties with a classical meaning, like the pendulum that swings and comes to rest eventually. The damping time, that would be the dissipation time here. The second time scale, which always comes with a damping influence of an environment, is the decoherence time, the lifetime of the relative phase, as a well-defined phase between two states in a superposition. And that decoherence time turns out to be again controlled by this parameter here. It's even the square of that parameter if one believes the golden rule. And the golden rule is indeed the popular technique, golden rule or Markovian master equations. That's really the same thing in a sense. Those are the most popular techniques of dealing with dissipation phenomena. And the golden rule predicts this kind of law. And if you go to the extreme of a macroscopic body, take the distance here as something like a centimeter or larger, and insert the de Broglie wavelength for a macroscopic body, you come out with an exceedingly small value of this ratio, and smaller yet is the square. So even when the dissipation time is something like a second, the decoherence, the loss of relative, well-defined relative phase in a superposition, is practically instantaneous if one wants to believe the golden rule. Well, let me just restate what I've just said in a more respectable way by finally looking at a quantum superposition of two states, and for the sake of concreteness, let me assume there is some macroscopic observable, could be any observable, doesn't need to be macroscopic at the moment, will eventually be, some observable with eigenstates and eigenvalues denoted by little s, and two such eigenstates I think of being brought to superposition. The density operator, referring to that pure state, is of course this well-known Ket-Bra, consisting of four terms, two of which are diagonal and the other ones are off-diagonal. The coefficients are bilinear in the coefficients in the state here. They're called probabilities here, and in the off-diagonal case, they're often called coherencies. Now, the statement I've just made, if the two states in question, or the two eigenvalues in question, are mesoscopically or macroscopically distinct, then suitable couplings of the system in question to a reservoir, the coupling involving this observable here as a coupling agent of the system, and there is some other coupling agent for the bath, such a coupling brings about the timescale separation for probability and coherencies as the golden rule predicts. Now, I'm not going to show you how the golden rule is applied to that. I think that's more or less common knowledge to almost everybody here, and it's not really the topic of my talk. I want to do something else eventually, as you will see presently. Let me throw in a numerical example, a slightly frivolous one. If the quantity under discussion has a dimension of a length, then lambda will be a quantum scale of reference, the de Broglie wavelength usually. Now, if you take for the wavelength Planck on momentum and evaluate it at room temperature as a thermal momentum, take d, the difference between the two eigenvalues in the superposition of order 1 centimeter. It doesn't really matter whether you put in a centimeter or a meter or a millimeter. Mass 1 gram, just to have something on the lab scale, and room temperature, then it is easy to see that the ratio of lambda and D is 10 to the minus 16. And the square of that would be 10 to the minus 32. And if one says, well, the decoherence time will be 10 to the minus 32 seconds, provided the dissipation time is 1 second, one certainly makes a dangerous statement. The golden rule is certainly not valid on such short time scales. And I've now arrived at the point I want to make here. It is really necessary to think about how, what happens on a very short time scale to a quantum superposition of two states in the presence of a coupling to the environment. The golden rule, which, as we all know, involves lowest order perturbation theory plus, and that's more important here, a long time limit. Is not valid. So what can one do? Well, the literature is not empty of answers to that question. There are exactly soluble models around, and some of the people present have worked on exactly soluble models. And then one sees that the answer is different from the prediction of the golden rule. But I don't want to enter the discussion of exactly soluble models here, because I want to make universal statements. And because it is actually possible to say something about the coherence process when it is really very fast in a universal way. And that is the principal object of the talk now. But before I enter such theoretical thoughts, it is well to throw a glance at the present day experimental situation. There are a number of interesting experiments of relevance to the question. The first one to mention maybe is Zeilinger's experiment of 2 or 3 years ago. He redid Young's double slit experiment in a slight variation, multi-slit diffraction, whole grating, and he threw not electrons on the one hand, not skiers either, but buckyballs, C60 molecules, and chose the velocity such that the Borel wavelength over the constant of the grating to be in the ratio 10 to the minus 5, meaning that the diffraction solid angle into which the diffraction pattern goes is minute, but not too small to resolve. And by resolving the diffraction pattern, and seeing the superposition of two partial quantum waves, or many, actually, because it was not a two-slit experiment, but a many-slit experiment, by observing and resolving the interference pattern, he set a still valid world record for the size, the mass of particles being capable of quantum interferences, C60. In order to make it possible, they had to do all sorts of tricks. They had to evacuate, eliminate as much as possible the dissipative influence of molecules in the air. They had to cool to even reduce the influence of dissipative coupling to the electromagnetic field. By doing making all sorts of such precautions, they arrived at resolving the interference patterns. They speculate, and that's interesting, that C60 molecules may not be the last word with respect to present-day technology. Large viruses or small bacteria might still allow to detect quantum interferences. Now, let's move on to an experiment of Serge Haroche and his group in Paris. These people realized superpositions of coherent states, or even Fock states, of a microwave cavity mode. The cavity modes are among the best available, such that the lifetime of a photon in the cavity is of the order of 160 microseconds. And then they were able to control the time scale ratio given by the golden rule in the range between 1 and 10. Well, that's nice, but not really enough to really make sure of the exponent 2 here. One would like to have at least 2 decades available to check on the prediction of the golden rule. A similar experiment was done by Wineland and his people in Boulder. They had superpositions of coherent states of translational motion of beryllium ions in a Powell trap, damped through irradiation. The electromagnetic field was the dissipative surrounding. And they controlled the timescale ratio in a somewhat larger range than the Paris group, but still leaving room for further experiments. Now, about a week ago, Hans Moy was here talking about his squid experiment, which has analogs realized in Stony Brook and more recently Orsay. These people have superpositions of counterpropagating supercurrents in small loops in squids. It has been argued that was a sensational finding, and in many ways it was, because if a milliamp current goes this way in superposition to a milliamp current going in the other sense, one certainly has 2 macroscopically distinct states brought to superposition. And so that begins to look like a Schrodinger cat state very much. But on the other hand, long discussions I had with Hans last week brought the result that probably these experiments are not in a regime where the ratio of d over lambda is really very large compared to unity. So they do not extend the range of accessible to the optical experiments and the trap experiments mentioned. For a very simple reason, one has a macroscopic degree of freedom moving in a double well potential, and the states brought to superposition are, roughly speaking, the state residing here and the state residing there. And the distance d is just the separation of the 2 wells in whatever space that plays. And the Broglie wavelength, the quantum scale of reference, is order of magnitude-wise the extent of the wave function in one of the wells. And that ratio is not very small. Its inverse is not very large. So they're in about the same range of the ratio dissipation time over decoherence time as the other experiments. So it would be beautiful to extend the range of experimentation so as to have several orders of magnitude, several decades for this ratio here, in order to really check on the prediction of the golden rule. The golden rule is valid in all of these cases because one has weak damping and relatively long decay times, even decoherence times. Wojtek.
Like with Edward Putnam, yes. If you stretch this ratio very, very far,
yes,
you might end up concluding that the square law saturates. And that does happen basically in the appropriate limit. So, I'm sure you know about it, but I'm just...
I didn't want to enter this direction of arguing because my old goal is a different one, as already announced, and I want to finally come to that.
There's actually a very beautiful experiment that shows that saturation, which is sort of an analog experiment by Mike Rinder.
And we maybe want to talk about that in the discussion later.
I think that there has been a down-to-earth problem with extending this to large ratio, because if D is much larger than lambda, the tunnel frequency will be like e to the minus some power of the over lambda. It will go to zero much faster than anything.
Yeah.
And therefore, it will be impossible to have coherence within the tunneling time.
Yeah.
So, in principle, this cannot be taken to the limit that you.
That I'm interested in. Okay. Yeah. Well, there are all sorts of other problems here. There, the phasing time is not controlled by the fundamental effects I have in mind here. It's just noise, which they were fighting against. So, let me now finally come to the main point of the talk. Let us go to the extreme limit where the decoherence time is really short, very short, compared to all other time scales in the business, not only to short compared to dissipation time, but also short compared to the time scales characteristic of the eigenmotion of the isolated system. That limit I want to study, and that limit tendentially is the one we live with in the macro world, because when the separation of two states goes into the macroscopic range, as the numerical example showed, one certainly is in the limit where decoherence is extremely fast a process. What can be done to solve the short time dynamics of the system, the composite system, the one subject to external influences and the environment, what one can do to treat the short time dynamics in the hope of catching decoherence in the macroscopic limit is this. One looks, only look at the last two lines here. One starts out having to deal with a Hamiltonian consisting of three parts, an eigenmotion of the isolated system, then the free motion of the surroundings or reservoir or bath, and an interaction. The interaction I will stick to as in this form here. Product of two coupling agents that can be generalized, and I'll have to say something about generalizations, but it's good enough for the moment. So in the limit where the decoherence time that remains to be calculated now, and that will be calculated now, is extremely short to time scales characteristic of the free motion of the system. The free motion, for instance, the oscillation period of a pendulum, a macroscopic pendulum. Okay, what I can do to treat that situation is to just forget about the eigen-Hamiltonian of the system, forget about the eigen-motion of the system, because by assumption, all processes generated by this one, by itself, are very slow compared to the process I have in mind. So goodbye, system Hamiltonian, and I have a Schrödinger equation to solve for the composite system where the Hamiltonian only has these two parts, the free bath Hamiltonian and the interaction. Okay. Eventually this can be criticized and will have to be criticized, but let's stick to that simplest possible situation. It is now an extremely simple calculation that leads to a decoherence time, and a decoherence time which differs in an interesting way from the one predicted by the golden rule, really a two or three line calculation. It all fits this one new graph. And the simplicity is due to the fact that the system coupling agent has become a constant of the motion, obviously. S commutes with both the interaction by this choice of an interaction and trivially with the eigen-Hamiltonian of the bath. The only part of the Hamiltonian that could cause S to move has been neglected. Okay. So that's the origin of the simplicity of this two-line or three-line calculation. So let's plunge into that, have no fear, it's really extremely elementary. We want to calculate the fate of the coherence between the state S and state S prime, assuming that the two eigenvalues are very different from one another. Well, you take the initial state of the composite system for simplicity. Again, that can be generalized, but that's good enough for the moment. We assume factorization, that is to say, statistical independence of the two parts of the composite system. And we time evolve with the truncated Hamiltonian. Okay. Then take the trace over the bath, because we are interested in a coherence of the system. And eventually take the matrix element between the two states S and S prime. Okay. Now, a short time approximation has already been made by neglecting the eigenmotion of the system. Having already done that, it is not much more of a sin to assume short times again and factor the exponential of the sum into two exponentials, each having only one of the pieces of the Hamiltonian upstairs. That is a short time approximation which we all know well, and know that the correction is of quadratic order in the time. And we will have to talk about that correction later. But let's, for the moment, just do this factorization, both to the left and to the right. Yes?
It's more than a short time in the sense that you are assuming that the coupling is weak, but you have assumed that this is
no.
Enough. Yeah, because you have S in the
commutator. Well, what I rely on is the that the commutator of these two, which controls the correction term, is of order t squared. Yeah? And okay, if the coupling is extremely weak, that also helps. You may assume that, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, but you assume that the coupling has to be large to cover the coherence time, which is very small.
No, you will see that. No way. Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's harvest the fruit of that factorization. Under the protection of the bath trace, I can cyclically shift the free evolution of the bath from the left to the right here, where I've done the analogous factorization for the adjoint evolution operator. And here at the right, it unites, it coalesces with its adjoint to unity. And goodbye now says the free Hamiltonian of the bath. And that's a wonderful thing to happen, because whatever will come out of the remainder of the calculation will be completely universal, will be independent of the character of the system, independent of the character of the bath as well, because neither of the free Hamiltonians plays a role any longer. Okay, now having done this, only the interaction appears here upstairs in the exponents, in the exponentials. And I may now exploit the fact that from the left, the coupling agent is met by its eigenstate little s, and correspondingly on the right, by its eigenstate with s prime. So I can replace on the left the observable by its eigenvalue s, on the right by s prime. And then this operator is an operator in the Hilbert space of the bath only. And I can again cyclically commute the left evolution operator to the right, where it coalesces with the right one, but not to unity, because S is not equal to S prime. Okay, just one second. And I arrive at this, which is essentially already the final result, apart from one little thought. A product of the initial coherence with a time-dependent factor, which describes the, hopefully describes the decoherence, and that time-dependent factor is nothing but the expectation value of this exponential here with respect to the initial state of the bath. Now, you had a question, excuse me.
It don't sound
well,
signal to pass to the bath, never come back. So there is kind of
That is always true when one arrives at irreversible behavior. And we have not quite done that yet. Let's postpone the question a little bit. This is a very general question which always arises when you derive dissipative behavior from a Hamiltonian motion of some larger systems with lots of degrees of freedom. It has a very general answer, and it does not. It's not necessary for the further arguments that we discuss this question right now. Let's do it at the end. Okay. Okay. So. Now, the final thought is the following. Since my environment is an environment, a bath, a reservoir, it must involve lots of degrees of freedom. And not only must these many degrees of freedom be somewhere in the bath, they must be in the coupling agent of the bath. This bath coupling agent must be, or else it could not serve as the coupling agent towards a bath. It must involve additively, it must involve lots of degrees of freedom. And for all examples I know, this involvement is an additive one. So this B is a sum of very many terms, which commute with one another. Now, if B, the coupling agent, is a sum of very many, many terms, then the central limit theorem tells you what this expectation value is. Gaussian statistics will arise for the coupling agent of the bath, and the average of the exponential is then nothing but the exponentiated variance of the original exponent. Yes, if for simplicity I assume that's really not important at all, but just makes for a simpler appearance of the equation, if I assume the mean of the bath coupling agent to vanish, then I just get the variance here, mean squared. Now, the average of the decoherence factor behaves like a Gaussian in time as a result. And the decay time is the square root of the inverse of the factor accompanying the t squared here. And you see that there is an acceleration of that decoherence process by a power of s minus s prime. That was what was called d previously, right? The distance. And the power law is different than in the golden rule. The golden rule said this decoherence time is proportional to the inverse squared of the distance. Not so here, it's proportional to the inverse modulus of the distance. So the power law is different than in the golden rule. Okay, so that's a result of the central limit theorem. And we have a very universal result here because it's independent of the character of the bath, of the system. In particular, it does not matter whether the bath is a collection of harmonic oscillators. That's by far the most popular model of a heat bath on the market. Could as well be a collection of n-harmonic oscillators or a collection of two-level atoms. It does not matter at all. The only thing that is important, and that must be assumed here, B is the sum of very many terms such that the central limit theorem holds. But that's not an outlandish assumption. That is the case for really all couplings of a single freedom system to an environment I know. Okay. So, does this already explain? I should discuss a little more. The correction terms here. Here was a t squared term. Well, that t squared term might appear at first glance to be in conflict with the t squared form of the result, but not so. But on taking the variance, which we do here, this t squared would combine with this t to a t cube. Okay, so the correction here is higher powers in the time. T cubed is the first correction term. Now the correction terms of higher order in T, T cubed, T4, and so forth, are not important in the limit when S minus S prime is very large, because the common factor of all these correction terms is S minus S prime squared. You open a bracket here, and then comes inside the bracket T cubed, and so forth. So this S minus, this acceleration factor is common to all powers of the time arising. That means you have a scaling variable here, S minus S prime modulus times T as a scaled time. And if you introduce that scaled time, then the cubic correction is smaller than the leading term by one order in D minus in S minus S prime. And that means when T S minus S prime is sufficiently large, then the Gaussian decay will be over before the T cubed term and higher order terms will be able to correct anything. No weight will be left. The correction will be there, but it will concern only the wing of the Gaussian. And that statement will be true, provided S minus S prime is large enough. And I'm allowed to go to that limit, because that's what I wanted to do in the first place. Now, have we already explained that the macro world due to interference does not, due to decoherence, does not know macroscopic superpositions? No, we have not yet, because we have a privileged basis here, the eigenbasis of the coupling agent S. Don't forget, I have figured out the temporal fate of the coherence of with respect to two eigenstates of the coupling agent S. Okay, so we must worry about what happens to macroscopic superpositions where two states are brought to superposition which are distinct not with respect to the coupling agent, but with respect to some other observable, maybe to a canonically conjugate momentum, conjugate to this S. And that's what I want to do here. Let us indeed look at eigenstates of a momentum P, which is conjugate to S, and stick to S, to the previous coupling to the environment, but now look at the temporal fate of a momentum space coherence. Now one does the same calculation as previously. No change, no change at all. Up to this point, where one had to do the average of an exponential. The exponential had here S previously, and that S could be replaced by its eigenvalue, little s on the left and little s prime on the right. So we had S minus S prime here. But now, since S work acts not on an eigenstate of itself, but rather on an eigenstate of the conjugate momentum, it acts on that in the well-known way, which we learn in elementary quantum mechanics as the differential operator. And H bar times d by dp, okay? So H bar times d by dp, and even an I. So the I has gone, the H bar cancels. H bar cancels. So instead of S minus S prime, we have d by dp plus d by dp prime. Now doing the Gaussian average with the same justification as before, we find the squared of this differential operator, and we see that the decay of the matrix element is not by a Gaussian as previously. It is rather like a diffusion process, diffusion with respect to the center of mass momentum, and with t squared as a time parameter. And the diffusion constant, that's the most important thing, not inversely proportional to Planck. Planck has completely disappeared here. So this diffusion is on a classical time scale. It's not on a quantum mechanically short time scale. So that's by comparison to the decay of the position space coherence, this remains unity when the position space decoherence has already decayed to zero. So it seems at this point of the reasoning that the coupling agent S is not capable of decohering superpositions of states which are distinct with respect to the conjugate momentum. Seems. So what is the way out? One way out is, of course, to now introduce another heat bath, which is coupled to the system by the momentum as a coupling agent, to have two baths. That is quite possible. And then there is more or less symmetry between the two representations, then everything decoheres in a basis-independent manner. So that's a trivial way out. Whether nature does that or not is a different story altogether. And it is whether nature always provides lots of heat baths, as many as there are non-commuting observables in the algebra. So that's an open question, which cannot be really answered on rational grounds. So it was rewarding to see that if you work a little harder, you see, and really Wojtek has forced us to think and work a little harder, so thanks, Wojtek. You work a little harder and throw in, when discussing the fate of the momentum space coherence, throw in a little bit of eigenmotion of the system, okay? Do not neglect entirely the system Hamiltonian. And that's what I propose to do here, and the calculation will again fit two view graphs, or one and a half, so we will be able to finish in time, have no fear. For the sake of simplicity, I do that by allowing only for a kinetic energy. It is not difficult to convince oneself in the end that the addition of a potential energy term would not change the picture qualitatively. It is really the kinetic energy that counts here. So let's have no fear and look at the time evolution operator, which has the sum of three Hamiltonians upstairs now. Eigenmotion of the system, eigenmotion of the bath, and then the coupling. To treat this, I want to have the reasoning as close to the previous one as possible, and therefore let me factor out the kinetic energy. Go to some kind of interaction picture with respect to the kinetic energy. Well, we all know how to do that from elementary quantum mechanics. We have as a cofactor of this evolution operator, the kinetic one, the exponentiated version of the remainder of the Hamiltonian in an interaction picture. The interaction picture defined with respect to the Hamiltonian that we've split off. Now, the interaction picture with respect to the kinetic energy is nearly trivial. It does not change the bath Hamiltonian at all, because that commutes with the kinetic energy of the system. And only to the interaction Hamiltonian here happens a little bit. And what happens? Well, what was S previously, the position, becomes S plus PT. As we all know, kinetic energy provides uniform velocity. And if you do the commutation algebra, you find just that. And it's trivial, and we've all done that in class. So we have the exponentiated version of this Hamiltonian, time ordered, of course. And the time dependence of the Hamiltonian is extremely simple, because it is only this additional term, PT prime B. And you see already the clue to the rapid decoherence. P has entered, yes, and will eventually be replaced by the eigenvalue little p on the left and little p prime on the right. So we will come to accelerated decoherence in precisely the same way as before, with slight modifications, which you will enjoy seeing. So in order to go on with the calculation and keep it again as closely related to the previous one, I split off a second factor, namely the one that I had dealt with previously, which I know already how to treat. What remains is the exponentiated version of the remaining part of the Hamiltonian not yet taken care of, and that is just this PBT prime. You will forgive me the sin of having set a mass equal to unity in order not to have to write so much. Okay, so that exponential we have here, and it is time times momentum times the Bath coupling agent, which appears here, and under a time integral, of course. Eventually, I will again invoke a short time approximation and will replace the integrand here, the P tilde and P and B tilde, the interaction picture versions of these observables, by their initial values, such that the time integral will simply give t squared over 2, t squared over 2. And that's really the only difference to the previous case, where I had t times coupling agent, I have t squared over 2 times. Now the new coupling agent, which was generated by the free motion of the system. Okay, fine. Now this exponential time evolution operator I insert into my matrix element and do the trace and do the same calculation as previously. There is no need to repeat. We jump immediately to the point where we can comment on the differences. Well, there is one factor, phase factor, obviously coming from the kinetic energy. It involves the difference of the kinetic energies of the two states here, P and P prime, both squared. Then there is what I had previously in this pessimistic first calculation, first treatment of the momentum space coherence, which upon averaging gave the diffusion, and with h bar missing from the diffusion constant, so that term is of course here, but it is now accompanied by the short time version of this time evolution operator, and here I have already replaced the observable p on the left by its eigenvalue little p, and on the right by little p prime, done the cyclic permutation as previously, and I'm done. Okay. Now, this phase factor is uninteresting. It does not describe decay. I'll carry it along here, but will not comment on it further. This term is extremely slow. It remains unity during the time at which the second factor will rapidly decay to zero. So this can be simply replaced by unity. If you want a more voluminous formula, you let it stand there right to the end. Nothing will change except that the formula, the final result, will be more bulky. The physics will not change. So I'm doing the Gaussian average with the one to the one important factor here. I again get b squared, p minus p prime squared, over h bar squared, and that's the important thing, times t4. Times t4, not t squared anymore. The momentum space coherence decays not like a Gaussian in time, but like e to the minus t4. And that on a time scale which involves h bar. So it is a decoherence time going to zero in the limit as Planck goes to zero. It does so with another power than previously. I have written out the two decoherence times, and I've written out the final result. Just to recall the temporal decay of the position space coherence, Gaussian, And the whole factor, cofactor of t squared, I have collected in this decoherence time with the index s for observable s, and the result some few graphs back is this one. You see the decoherence time proportional to h bar, inversely proportional to the difference of the two eigenvalues, and of course also inversely difference to that is a mistake. I believe I've forgotten a square root. Have I forgotten a square root? Yes, a square root of this expectation value. Yes, I'm sorry. So don't want to let something wrong stand here. The same thing will happen down there. Okay. On the other hand, the momentum space coherence decays like e to the minus t4, that is to say much more slowly. Slowly, yes. Also the time scale tau decoherence index p for momentum is now the fourth root of the cofactor of t4 in the exponent, and it is thus read off as the square root of Planck over the difference, and then the root mean square of the coupling agent of the bath. So the powers have changed, the exponents have changed in the power law. It's the square root of Planck, and it is the square root of the difference, what was Planck itself and the difference up there. And recall the golden rule had yet another exponent. It had 1 over difference squared. Okay, so that's the result. We do have universal decoherence of superpositions of macroscopically distinct states, and the calculation shown is really wonderfully simple. It was a big surprise to see that, how simple the argument really is, and you don't have to rely on exactly soluble models. It's a completely universal result pertaining to the macroscopic limit, of course. The time scale on which decoherence takes place goes to zero, as formerly Planck goes to zero, with different powers according to the observable with respect to which the two states in the superposition are distinct. And it's a universal phenomenon because, I repeat, there is complete independence of the character of the bath. The bath can be made up of harmonic oscillators, anharmonic oscillators, two-level atoms, what have you. It does not matter at all. And character of the system Hamiltonian is really very unimportant as well. I think we can leave the discussion of the unimportance of potential energy as a fine detail, a technicality to the experts or to the discussion if you wish. I have no problem. I have only joy in discussing this. But I think we ought to consider the talk over. Thanks. Sure, yes.
What happens if you take all the solvable models? For example, you take the bucket from the cluster,
yeah.
Everything down on the cluster, the potential energy,
yeah.
Is important?
Okay. It is not important at all.
So
no. Yeah, I can come back to this from an exactly soluble model by solving for the model you cited, that you find the normal modes and construct whatever quantity you want. And for instance, the time-dependent coherence. And upon extrapolating that result, which is valid for arbitrary time, back to small times, you find this and that. Yeah.
But small times, right?
I mean, but small times, yeah. But it is important that, none of this is of relevance for the present-day experiments. The present-day experiments, as I've said, are perfectly well described by the golden rule. Yeah. There, the decoherence time even is larger than the time scale of the system. So this result, this universal result, pertains to the truly macroscopic limit. And there, everything is simple. Yeah, I think Joe was the first one.
My first comment on the technical problem and then a real question. I think in many properties of any system, especially if improving in correlation functions by results, there is some property which may be called asymptotic freedom.
Yes.
In a limit of very short times, the interaction is not felt. Physically, it means that if you look at the system at a time of 10 to the minus 50 seconds,
yeah,
the part can just move freely, inertially, doesn't know about the interaction.
That's at the basis of this.
To justify this.
Yeah,
problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the question is this, there is another set of words that people use to discuss this problem. They say the following. If I take this virus of Anton Zeilinger is growing from the 60,
yes,
and move it in very rarefied gas.
Yeah.
So, the virus is made of N particles, and at least all the surface of the virus is interacting with it, these very rarefied gas. And each of the atoms on the surface of the virus can knock a little bit one of the atoms of the gas. So it's not surprising that the time that the whole virus does something is somehow goes like one over the area of the surface.
Yes.
Of the virus.
Yeah.
And that immediately tells you that in the macroscopic limit, these times will be very small.
I'm really grateful to the point you make, because that point is essentially in here. The variance of the coupling agent of the bath also makes this time scale small, because this typically is proportional to square root of the number of degrees of freedom.
So, two-thirds or whatever, depending on shape.
Yes, yes. That's in there,
that
in principle.
Is here.
That is here. Yes, yes. I mean, naively arguing, the central limit theorem says this: if B is a sum of n terms, then the mean squared of B would be proportional to n indeed, yes, because the off-diagonal terms vanish, average to zero. So we have n proportionality to n, and square root of n would remain here. Maybe the power could have changed a little bit, but a power of n enters here with a positive exponent, yes. And that's essentially, I think, the point you want to make. Okay, yes.
One other class of experiments that you didn't mention that I wonder how it fits into the scheme, and that's atomic parameter experiments.
Yes.
Where you have a fairly big atom, like cesium, 133 mass units that are split over close to centimeter distance.
Yeah.
And how that relates to the saturated comment that the Voracek projected earlier on.
That is quite
how
possible.
Do those experiments and the fact that you can actually see those fringes, how does that fit into this discussion of the breakdown or not breakdown?
I think the golden rule is valid for all of these experiments, because the decoherence time is not exceedingly short. It is usually, in the metaphoric language of the damped harmonic oscillator, right? You have a damped oscillation, and the dissipation time is much longer than an oscillation period, and if you divide by in the limit of very weak damping, where the golden rule is valid, yes, divide that by even 100 or 1000, yes, that's the range of present day experiments, you still have a decoherence time sometimes longer than the system period, and at any rate not exceedingly small compared to it. So one is still in the limit of validity of the golden rule. And I think that's the status of this type, roughly speaking. Yes, our treatment does not apply there.
Can I comment?
Sure.
I want to
perhaps clarify where does the saturation business come from? Because it's sort of interesting. You see, in all of the models that all of us are doing, whenever we are doing anything exact, we have a system which moves in coordinate X, an environment which moves in coordinate Q. It doesn't happen in the real world. In the real world, both the system and the environment move in the same coordinate. Now, if you recognize this, you end up looking basically at the question of where the environment is consisting of wave packets which are incoherent and the scale at which it's trying to decohere the system. So you have a square power law up to the limit where hitting the atom or photon of the environment pushes it one way or the other, but by the time you have separations which are large enough so that you never encounter things which are coherent anyway, you are saturated. So you know, this means that if you are doing experiments with separations of 1 centimeter, say in a photon environment, which has typical wavelength, thermal wavelength, much shorter, you will be probably in the saturation. You are doing it in the situation where you are dealing with very long wavelengths. There's a paper we've written some years ago with Juan Pablo and Fazen and Dimani, trying to sort of undo all of these simple laws and deconstructing the coherence, right? So a lot of counterexamples to the popular rules of thumb are there.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, no.
If you want to connect with the macro world, shouldn't you do this on, say, like coherent states? Because the momentum and coordinate states are very, very bad in the limit.
Yeah. No,
so I think
you're completely right.
Which dependence might be different?
For one thing, of course, I have to work with wave packets. There must be wave packets. For instance, coherent state or any other wave packet superimposed with another one. Yes, and I probe this wave packet by taking expectation value with respect to eigenstates of whatever observable. Yeah. Right, and then coherencies which reside within the width of one peak are not amenable to this discussion here, because unless this were itself a macroscopic width, but I'm assuming this to be a small width, but this, here's the separation. And I probe the superposition of wave packets with these states here. These states, S and P in themselves, literally speaking, they're not even normalizable.
Right.
Yeah, okay. But nevertheless, everything I've done is correct. I can use these matrix elements. Yes.
No, but what I mean is, instead of S and S prime, you have two wave packets which are in different places.
Yeah, I do. I could do the probing also with coherent states. Yes, yeah, you could do that. Yeah,
but
that would make for slightly more difficult calculations, but you could do that, of course. Essentially, the same result.
How is the H dependence in
the target? The H dependence, absolutely identical.
But there is difference between
Wait. Coherent states can be taken, you can take a superposition of two coherent states differing with respect to X or with respect to P. S, I had said, it should stick to that, S and P, yes? And you can, of course, rotate the pair, the Schrödinger cat, so to speak, rotate a little bit, that's an interesting question. Once your initial state is rotated enough such that there is already a macroscopic distinction with respect to the coupling agent S, then this power would come in. If you're very close initially to a pure momentum space cat in the coherent state language, then this would come in. And there is a transition which I have not treated quantitatively. Yes.
In fact, I think your P power 4 power law,
yes,
which comes into the coherence of momentum, is due to what you've just described.
Yes.
right? So you have absolutely two packets which are separated.
Yes, yes.
So that orthogonality goes like...
I should have said that. That was a terrible sin. Yeah. Yes.
Right,
yeah. All the kinetic energy does here is turn the original P cat a little bit so as to make the two states distinct also with respect to position.
Yes.
And then the decohering effect of the coupling agent S can begin.
So the profound statement is that this T power 4 is a product of T squared and T squared.
Okay, that's a good final word. Sure.
The solid pool models, let's say, they have one constant of a to a
yes.
What is exactly the decoherence time scale? How does it determine the parameters
I think I must essentially repeat what I've said. If your initial superposition is distinct with respect to the coupling agent, then you can calculate the temporal fate of the matrix element written out here, express it in terms of normal modes, have a rigorous result. You specialize that to for early times. You make a plot. Actually, Walter Schunz is just doing plots, and he will show you plots, if you wish, of this decoherence function. So if you have a distinction of the initial state with respect to the coupling agent, then you find this decoherence time. And if you have a distinction only with respect to the momentum, while the coupling agent is the displacement, then you have this decoherence time here. And there is a transition, yes, which has probably no nice and simple analytic form, yes. But you, if it is, it can be read off the rigorous result, which is in the literature. Yes, I've myself written a paper a long time ago, but many other people also have. It's, yes. All of this is valid only in the case that the decoherence time is extremely short compared to the free oscillation period of the oscillator. Yeah, yeah. Ah, that's an interesting question, yes. The cutoff of the bath is in here, yes. And for the oscillator model, you can evaluate that, and you get an integral which depends on a single parameter, which is the cutoff energy over the thermal energy, kT, yes. And I have evaluated that integral only in the limit where the thermal energy is small compared to the cutoff energy. And then the dependence of this decoherence time scale on the cutoff is 1 over cutoff energy. Yes, in the limit where the temperature is, the thermal energy is small compared to the cutoff energy. There is, in the form of an integral, you have a full temperature dependence. And I have, at this moment, only evaluated the asymptotic result mentioned. But Walter assures me that the integral can be done analytically for all temperatures.
Well, perhaps we should let Fritz off the hook. I'm sure he's happy to answer further questions if you have them. But let's thank him again.